This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. I'm Naomi, and today I will be reading from A Place for Us by Nicholas Gage. We are resuming Chapter 18. When I returned to the village, the celebration of the prophet's feast hadn't changed from the day of my birth. The inhabitants of the village still climbed to the chapel perched on a ledge high above the timberline where the priest celebrated a service for the prophet. On July 20, I awoke later than most villagers as usual. I could see a dark line of people high up on the mountainside wending their way toward the chapel. I wanted to go to the church service, I told Anitza, who was bustling about, but she replied, "It's too late. By the time you got up there, it would be over. Let's just get our things and go up to the Virsi so we can get the best spot." The Virsi was a spring that flowed across a triangle of flat land tucked into the mountain above the Pirivoli, but below the chapel of the prophet. This natural plateau, set against sheer cliffs, included a narrow pond where the village women did their laundry, and here the festivities were always held. The space made a natural dance floor, and a raised area near the cliff was a stage where the itinerant, dark-skinned Yifti musicians would stand. These mysterious nomads of Egyptian descent appeared every year to play for the festival with their clarinet, fiddle, and tambourines. The dancers, moved by the kifi of the music and drink, tossed money into a hat to pay for them. Above the Virsi, the cliffs were pocketed with caves where the people of these mountains had taken refuge from the invaders since the days of Alexander the Great. Here the Leotes once hid from the Turks, and here my mother and sisters and I took refuge from the invading Italians when I was a year old. Below the Virsi, where my mother's trial had been held after the nationalist troops had fired on the town's central square. Nitsa and I hurried up the mountain past St. Demetrius Church, our old neighborhood, and my ruined house, past the mill pond where my mother used to beat our laundry on the rocks with tree branches, up to the Virsi, where people were already spreading rugs, trying to commander a spot with a good view of the dance floor and near enough to the pond to chill beer and watermelons. My Aunt Nitsa was so eager that she reached the Virsi ahead of me. When I caught up with her, panting from the steep climb in the thin atmosphere, I said, "I thought you were too sick to make it up the mountain. How did you manage to beat everybody else?" "Well, I've been resting and regaining my strength," she mumbled defensively. "After all, this is only once a year. Come on, let's get something to eat." The proprietors of the village store and the coffee house had been roasting lambs on spits since before dawn. They sold beer, wines, and reiki, and meat from the spitted carcasses, charging by weighing each portion with a handheld scale. Soon Uncle Andreas and Barba Photo arrived, descending the mountainside from Prophet Elias. With them was Leonardus Karamapoulos, the owner of the kiosk in the village and husband of Athena, the woman who had told me about the trial. "I didn't see you up there," Leonidas said to me, extending his hand in greeting. "I got up too late for the church service," I replied. "Right behind the chapel is the ravine where they shot your mother and aunt," said Leonidas. "If you want, I'll take you up there now and show you where it happened and where they put the bodies." "No, not now," I said, horrified at the thought of standing where my mother stood as she realized her life was over. "Why do you say such things to the boy on a day like this?" cried Leonardo's wife. "This is a day for celebration, not painful memories." She led him away. People had returned for the Panini from Salonika, Kalamata, Athens, even as far as Germany. In the crowd, I saw many of my own age, former playmates who had been taken in the Pedamesamo as children and had returned as adults. Some came over to greet me, among them a young woman named Magdalene Kirku, a few years older than I, who was in the last group of children taken from our village days after my mother's execution and shortly before the nationalist troops attacked and the guerrillas decided to retreat into Albania. "There were about 30 children in our group," Magdalene told me. "Many mothers followed us, weeping and begging the guerrillas to give their children back. They followed us all the way to the border. Then the guerrillas told them to leave or they'd be shot. One little boy, George Siopoulos, who was 9, was bitten on the way by a rabid dog. But the guerrillas kept saying, 'Don't worry, he'll be fine once he's inside. We have doctors to treat him.' But in Albania, he went crazy. They shut him up in a room and tied him because he was biting his own hands. He died in terrible pain. We were starving by the time we reached Durazzo," Magdalene continued. "A Russian ship stopped to unload wheat, and we ripped a bag open and ate it, stuffing the raw wheat into our mouths. You can imagine how sick we got. In Durazzo, they took out the older children to train as soldiers and loaded the rest of us onto trucks and drove us to Belgrade. Then they sent us on trains to Romania, still in the same clothes, no baths, no food. They told us if we made a sound, they'd shoot us. They didn't want the civilians to know it was a train of kidnapped children. When we finally got to the camps in Romania, they decided that at 14 I was old enough to fight, so they sent me back to Albania." Hearing tales like this made me realize again what we had escaped through my mother's sacrifice. If I hadn't fled the village, I would have spent years of my childhood starving in camps behind the Iron Curtain, and perhaps would have been so thoroughly brainwashed that, like many of the 28,000 children taken in the Pedomisoma, I would never return. Worse, our family would have been separated, like so many, from Leah. Me in re-education camp in Romania, my sisters sent to fight in other countries, scattered like leaves across the communist world. The village woman had told me that on the third day of my mother's trial, as the charges were being read against her, the judge, Kadis, called for a recess so that parents could say goodbye to a group of children being led up the mountain towards Albania. The scene became pandemonium as the mothers took their children in their arms for the last time. As she watched, my mother smiled, knowing that even if she was killed, her children were safe. The 9-year-old son of one of the village's foremost communists, a little boy named Sotiris Bolis, was in the group, and he asked my mother in front of everyone, "Where's Nicola? Why isn't he going with us?" She hugged him and replied softly, "Nicola's gone to his father." Then the children were led up the mountain, and the trial resumed to the sound of muffled sobs. As I listen to stories of the last days of the Civil War and the diaspora that followed, the plateau became crowded with revelers, and the musicians began to play the mournful, slow dances of our mountains. Everyone moved back to clear the center for the dancers, linked hand to hand, moving sideways in a sinuous line with measured, stately steps as ancient as Greece itself. As the line of dancers approached, someone reached out and pulled me into it. I was no expert, but I did know the steps to the tsimiko, the dance of Epiros, beloved by the mountain fighters during the War of Independence. Although the dance is slow, dignified, and warlike, the man at the head of the line is expected to do acrobatic feats, supported by a handkerchief firmly grasped by the next dancer. When my turn came to lead the dance, I wasn't skilled enough to do the aerial somersaults performed by the best palikaria, but I managed some spins over and under the handkerchief. Then I saw Uncle Photo, a renowned dancer, even at 81, come up and take the handkerchief to support me. Under his encouragement, I managed some leaps and turns that drew hisses of appreciation from the audience, along with an occasional oopa. My uncle took my place, relying on my strength to keep him from falling as he bent back, nearly letting his head touch the ground, and then crouched, doing a powerful kick step. The onlookers cheered to see the patriarch of our family still outdancing the youths. Soon I noticed my relatives, Photo's children and grandchildren, all hurrying to take a place in the line, until the slow-moving serpentine of dancers was composed almost entirely of the Gatsoyanis clan. The musicians moved closer, playing their instruments in my uncle's ear to fill his body with the rhythms. I saw tears in the eyes of many of my relatives, for by this dance at the Vrissi we were bearing witness that the murders of my mother and Aunt Alexo had not destroyed our clan. Despite the best efforts of envious villagers, we had been the dominant family in the village once, and now we were stronger and more numerous than ever. Even the son of the Americana had returned to these peaks to dance, the dance of Epirios, and prove that by her death, Eleni Gatsoyanis had given her children life. Sometime during that afternoon, as I was talking to a young woman from Babori, taking care, as my father had warned me, not to seem too forward, I noticed my grandparents staring at me quizzically with a look I had seen before. During the early morning hours, when I lay in bed, they got up to do the chores. I often heard them whispering about me in the next room, and when I went in, they would fall silent, looking at me strangely. "What are you staring at?" I'd ask in irritation, but they would always change the subject. One night, shortly after the festival, I was sleeping in my grandparents' house when I was awakened by an eerie, almost inhuman moaning coming from outside. It continued, a terrible sound of pain, raising the hairs on my arm. I remembered how the Germans had burned this very house in 1944 and thrown Fodi Heidis' aged grandmother into the flames because the old woman, who had refused to flee the village with the others, was screaming at them for incinerating her goats. After the villagers returned and found her skeleton in the coals, her voice could sometimes still be heard in the ravine, calling for her grandson, "Photo, Photo." Even my sisters had heard her. Now I wondered if the moaning was the uneasy soul of old Anastasia Heidis. After listening for a while longer, I decided the only possible explanation was that someone had fallen into the deep ravine nearby, broken some bones, and was calling for help. I woke my grandfather and whispered, "Listen." He picked up the big flashlight I had brought him and went outside to investigate. I waited in suspense, but when he finally returned, he had a small smile on his face. He reached for a cigarette from the pack that sat on the mantel and lit it with a match scraped on the stone. My grandmother came into the room asking, "Why is everybody up? What's going on?" "I couldn't stand it anymore. Tell me," I implored my grandfather. "What is it, that moaning?" "It's just a she-goat," he smiled. "Is she dying?" I exclaimed. "No, she's not dying. She's in season. She wants a ram. She's just frustrated." "And she's moaning like that?" I asked. "How long has this been going on?" "Oh, about a week," he replied. "Imagine carrying on that way," I said dryly. "I haven't been near a woman for 5 weeks now, and you don't hear a sound out of me." "Nicola," my grandmother beamed, "and we thought you were a virgin." My grandfather's usually dour features broke into a huge grin of relief and pride. "That's a Hados talking, not a Gatsianas," he said with a chortle. As July drew to an end, I knew it was time to go back to Athens, but I resolved to return to the village for the anniversary of my mother's death before leaving for America. I told my grandparents that I had work to do in Athens and some people still to see, but that I would be back. I also distributed most of my wardrobe to various relatives to lighten my luggage, but also because I had discovered how much my smallest possessions would mean to people who wore the same clothes all year round. Even the handkerchiefs and small bars of soap I had with me were luxuries to the old women of the village. I had to go back to Athens to research the identities of the military leaders of the communists in our mountains, but I also needed to return to civilization for a while. In college, I had read Rousseau's romantic notions of the noble savage, but in Lea, I moved back into the Middle Ages and discovered that while the landscape was magnificent, the life of the village was harsh, brutal, and squalid. There was no way to keep clean except for a rare sponge bath, because there was no running water, only distant icy springs. Everyone sat on the floor and ate from the same pot, and dishwashing meant a casual rinse in the stream. There was no electricity, no street lamps or light bulbs, so darkness fell with the force of a blow, leaving us with little to do but sleep. The hard, isolated life made people vengeful, suspicious, and superstitious. When I was a child, I knew nothing else and so never noticed the desperately primitive conditions. But now I was longing for a bath, clean underwear, and a meal at a table from a clean plate. "I'll come back before I leave Greece," I promised my grandfather. He looked at me hard and asked, "You're not deceiving me?" "No, I'll be back, I promise," I said. Nietzsche scoffed. Kanta promised. "Just like that, after her wedding," she said. "Did she ever come back? Did Fotini and Minos return as they promised?" "Don't be a fool, Patera. He's just saying that so we won't make a big fuss." "Shut up," snapped my grandfather. "If Nicola says he'll come back, then I believe him." I took the daily bus out of Lea as my relatives gathered to wave me off, Nietzsche wailing the ear-shattering merolodia, or morning songs of the village, which could be heard from one mountaintop to another. Soon I was back in the luxury of the Amalia Hotel. As soon as I had bathed, I went to the Greek Armed Forces archives on a side street not far from the hotel. I told the uniformed military officer at the desk that I was a student preparing a research paper on the history of the Greek Civil War, and I wanted to look up some information about the leaders of the communist guerrilla army. At first, he seemed speechless at my nerve. Then he found his voice and informed me, as if speaking to a child, that without authorization from the Ministry of Defense, there was no way I could get access to their files. Realizing I hit a dead end, I decided to try another track. I got in touch with Minos Stratus, a man in his 50s, who had once been the respected schoolteacher in Leah, before his nationalist sympathies put his life in danger in the early years of the Civil War. After being hidden for 40 days in the cellar of a relative, the tall, gangly scholar had managed to escape and take up residence in Yanina, where he found a job as a schoolteacher and worked during the Civil War for the Greek Military Intelligence Service, Alpha Dio, as well. Minos was a second cousin of my mother. Shortly before the invasion of the guerrillas in Leah, when mother had traveled to Philades in an attempt to fill out the necessary papers for immigration to America, he had encountered her and warned her to move out of the village at once, for it would be dangerous for the Americana and her children if guerrillas came. But Mana was under orders from my father to stay put. Minos was now a grammar school teacher in Athens, and I knew he still had good contacts in the military. I called him and asked him to meet me at Zonar's one sweltering afternoon. Despite the terrible heat, he arrived dressed in his usual suit, high-collared shirt and tied. He greeted me as if 15 years hadn't passed since we had last seen each other, then reproved me for the casual slacks and open collared shirt I was wearing. It behooves you to set a good example by wearing a suit and tie, he chided me in his formal Greek. As an individual who has matriculated from the university and who has met the President of the United States, you should present a good appearance to others. When I told him that I needed his help to find out the names of the guerrillas in our village because I wanted to write about my mother's trial and execution, he responded as a schoolteacher would from an ideological and historical viewpoint. You shouldn't focus on the individuals responsible for the crimes against your mother, he said. That only distracts people from the guilt of the party leaders. These trials and executions were political charades carried out in every occupied village to terrify the civilians into obedience, especially at the end when the guerrillas realized they were losing and would have to retreat and take the civilians with them to fuel future armies. Commissars like Koulianis made the decisions to execute certain individuals long before the trials. The guilt for your mother's murder rests squarely on the leaders of the Greek Communist Party. Her judges and jailers were just puppets. The leaders may have formulated the policy, but why kill my mother? I interrupted. I need to find out the names of the villagers who informed on her. Who were the jailers who tortured her? That was a personal, not a policy decision, wasn't it? To beat her until she couldn't walk? Individuals did that. I want their real names. I need to see the faces of the people who tortured and shot her. I can't settle for hating the entire leadership of the Communist Party. Most of them left their bones to rot on the slopes of Gramos and Vitsi during the last months of the war, he told me. The ones who survived are now scattered all over the communist world, from Warsaw to Tashkent, beyond your reach. So what good will it do to know their names? I want to write it down, I said. I want to write all the details for me and my sisters and our children, Eleni's grandchildren. I want them to know what sort of a woman their grandmother was, and how she suffered and died, and who was responsible. I'm going to do it for my family and my mother's memory, nothing else. In the end, Minos agreed to use his contacts in the military and try to learn the identities behind the nicknames I gave him. But a few days later, he invited me to his house for lunch and told me he had no success. This is the wrong time, he said, because we have a caretaker government and elections are coming up, Everyone's very nervous. I called someone at the archives, but they don't have listings by nicknames. Everyone's afraid liberals will win power, and they won't want to stir up the past. If you could come back with credentials from a news organization, you might get somewhere. But a student, and during a transitional government, I'm sorry, Nick, but I can't do any more. My advice is to leave it alone. The ones who are still alive, they'll get what's coming to them someday. On my way back to my hotel, I realized that Minos was at least partly right. I would have to postpone my research until I had the professional skills and credentials to enable me to track these men down, just as I wasn't ready emotionally to face the whole truth about my mother's torture and death, or even to walk into the basement where she had suffered. I wasn't ready with the skills and experience to find her killers. The best thing I could do for now, I concluded, was to go to graduate school, hone my journalistic skills, and increase my professional clout until I could come back and follow her story to its end. I returned to the village in mid-August, stopping in Filiades to fill my nearly empty suitcase with more pastries and sweets. When the taxi deposited me at my grandfather's house and he came out into the courtyard, he flushed with pleasure, but only said, "You've come back." When Nitza arrived, out of breath from hurrying across the village to see what was happening, Grandfather snapped, "Now, will you admit you're wrong?" I knew he wouldn't lie to me. I could tell that, in fact, he had doubted he would ever see me again. By returning, I had risen several notches in his estimation. Our pleasant round of eating, sleeping, and idling in the coffee house continued as the villagers began to harvest a wealth of grapes, figs, tomatoes, corns, and walnuts, and a cornucopia of delicacies that made it easy to observe the two-week fast preceding the Virgin's feast day on August 15th. But as I joked, played, and ate, I was aware that during his harvest period 15 years before, my mother had been arrested and the last tragic events of her life had begun to unwind, culminating with a burst of gunfire. My sisters had warned me not to attempt a full memorial service on the anniversary of our mother's death, for that required a week of cooking and complicated protocol that they felt was beyond me. Only they, steeped in village tradition, could carry out all the rituals without risk of tarnishing our family's reputation. So on August 28th, the anniversary of her murder, I walked up to the church of St. Demetrios, accompanied only by the gray-bearded village priest, Father Nicholas, an acolyte, my aunt and uncle, my grandfather and grandmother, and Uncle Photo. We entered the ossuary and stood before the small box that held the bones of my mother and of Baba Photo's wife, Alexo, as the priest swung his censer and chanted the Trisagion and thrice holy prayer for the dead, while the perfumed smoke drifted heavenward. We were all silent for our memories. Only my grandmother sobbed softly. I tried to sense my mother's presence. Did she know I had come back despite her command, I wondered, and did she understand why I had to do it? But I felt no hint of her spirit nearby. Since my return to the village, my mother had appeared in my dreams several times, and my sisters dreamed of her often, but theirs were always messages from the world of the dead. In mine, however, she was always alive, moving about her house and the village paths, doing tasks that used to fill her days while I followed her. When we returned to the Hades house after the Trisagion service, my aunt and grandmother lay down for the siesta. My grandfather went out on the veranda to smoke, and I followed him. I could tell he was still thinking about my mother. She had always been his favorite because Eleni was the only one in his family with an intelligence to match his own. but their relationship had been volatile. "You came back, and I'm grateful, Nicola," he said to me now, and I could tell that every word was difficult for him. I'd always hoped for a son to carry on the Haidas name, but it wasn't to be. God sent me all daughters, most of them dead as soon as they were born. Because Nitsa is barren, you're the only male to carry my blood. Once again, I couldn't help wondering how much I was destined to inherit my grandfather's nature along with his blood. "I want to tell you something I've never told anyone," he went on. Not looking at me, but leaning on the railing of the house he rebuilt with his own hands after the Germans burned it. He gazed down at the clouds, drifting like sheep over the foothills below. "I once killed a man," he said tonelessly, "a Turk. It was 1916, and I was working a mill outside Urmiri that I had rented for the summer. We were vassals of the Turks then, and this brigand started coming around, telling me I had to pay him a percentage of my profits, or my mill might burn down. It was a common practice in those days, demanding protection money from any prosperous Greek. Well, one day, after agreeing to pay him his tithe, I started serving him tispuro, and then, when he was good and drunk, I took an axe off the wall behind him and split his skull open. I buried him beneath the stones that line the channel of the millstream, redirecting the water into an emergency ditch while I dug the hole, then putting the stones back. The bones are still there under the millstream at Urmiri, and will be until the second coming." I was relieved I had solved my problem so easily, he went on. "No one ever did connect me with the Turk's disappearance. But your mother, she was 9 at the time, had been visiting me and was asleep in the loft of the mill when I killed the bastard, so I thought. She saw the whole thing. I could tell from the way she looked at me afterwards. She never said a word about it to anyone, including her mother. But every time I looked at her, I could see her eyes accusing me." He said nothing more, and together we stared southward at the gray Lafithian humps of mountains in the distance, the farthest boundary of my world until the night of our escape. My grandfather never again mentioned the man he had killed, but he had given me the key to his thorny relationship with my mother. She had known his crime and had constantly reminded him of it through the fear in her eyes. Despite his cynicism, I knew that, like all Greeks, he believed the sins of the father are visited on the children. My mother had died violently, and he undoubtedly felt this was punishment for the blood staining his own hands. God has taken his favorite child in retribution for his secret crime. Eventually, I understood that my grandfather's confession to me was an overture of friendship and an attempt to win my absolution for what he had done. He felt responsible for my mother's death, and not just because he had left us behind in the village. But he didn't say any of this on that anniversary of her execution. Only one sentence, delivered in a tone of resigned irony. "You lost your mother," he said, "but I lost my Eleni. And God left me with Nitsa." At that moment, I felt closer to my grandfather than I ever did before or after. By confessing, he seemed to be asking for my love and forgiveness. My opinion of him by then was much higher than when I had first arrived in Greece. But shortly before I left for good, he demonstrated once again why I had feared him so as a child. It was a few days after the memorial service when a relative came from the distant village of Vasila to pay her respects to my grandfather, and he directed Nitsa to bring coffee and water. When she complied, grandfather said, "Where are the pastries that Nick brought? Serve us some of those." "They're all gone. The villagers have eaten them," Nitsa responded. The villagers, you've eaten them all, you greedy pig, he thundered, rising to his feet. Nothing is safe around here with you and your useless husband bleeding us like vampires. You've eaten my food for 50 years now, and I'm sick of it. With that, he started throwing things, kicking over furniture and smashing dishes against the wall, screaming curses at Nitsa, while the veins in his neck and forehead bulged to alarming size. Both the visitor and I tried to calm him, while Nitsa and Andreas scampered to safety. My grandmother burst out crying. "You've got to get a hold of yourself," I shouted. "Stop this. This is crazy." But it was as if he couldn't hear me. His temper had taken over, and he was unable to stop, still swearing at the top of his lungs and trashing the room. Finally, after the visitor had gone out the door with undignified speed, I shouted at my grandfather, "If you don't stop this ranting, I'm packing my things and leaving." But he didn't stop, only glared at me as if he'd like to kick me the way he was kicking the furniture. So I threw my few belongings into my suitcase and walked out. Once outside the door, I found Nitsis and Andreas lurking in the courtyard. "Come sleep at our house," Nitsa whispered. "You know it's not safe when he gets like this." "No, that would look like I'm taking sides," I'd answered. "I'll sleep at Baba Fudo's." As I walked down the road, I could still hear my grandfather shouting and raving at my grandmother, wailing and taunting him. "That's right. Break everything we own. You've managed to drive Nicola away. Now let's see what else you can do to ruin us." The next day, my grandmother found me at Fudo's and convinced me to move back. My grandfather's fury had passed, and we had disappeared. He had disappeared, as he often did after these tantrums, probably to sleep in his deserted mill until he could control himself. He and I were coldly civil for the remaining days of my stay, but when I left the village, I understood better than ever why my mother had been so eager to marry and leave this house. Any man her father chose as her husband, she knew, would probably be an improvement on her father and his temper. She had been fortunate that Christos Gatsianis, despite his faults, turned out to be a loving and generous man, often wrong-headed in his decisions, but willing to admit his mistakes and not one to harbor anger. When it was time for me to leave for good, Aunt Nitsa wailed just as loudly as before, but I sensed more emotion in the quiet goodbye of Andreas and in my grandfather's parting words. "I hope you will remember us kindly and come back before I die," he said. "It won't be the same after you're gone." My grandmother, addressing no one in particular, complained loudly. "I wish he'd never come back. I'd got used to life without him, and now I'm going to have to start all over again." On my flight from Athens to Boston, I couldn't sleep, so I had plenty of time to ponder the differences between the two countries that had been my home and the two men who had served as my role models. During the summer, I had learned to admire my grandfather for his cleverness, wit, and resourcefulness. No matter how bad things got in Greece, though, through war and famine, he was never down to his last drachma. He was totally self-sufficient and had always managed to survive better than anyone else. No one ever took advantage of him or made him look like a fool, because he was always on guard, expecting the worst from everyone. My father, in contrast, like many Americans, trusted too easily. He was guileless and naive in judging people, so he was easily exploited and he never managed to save any money. In fact, he always was swayed by the opinion of the last person who had talked to him. Nevertheless, I preferred my father's generous nature and innocent optimism to my grandfather's vicious temper and suspicious nature, and despite his bluster, my father never killed anyone. He would get angry and then forget his grievances within hours. My grandfather would hold a grudge for years, and everyone feared him. Even though I resembled my grandfather more, I resolved on that flight back to America to find a middle ground between the two men and to emulate my father's good qualities as much as possible. If that made me an Americanaki, it was still better than ending up like my grandfather, lonely and bereaved of those he loved best, haunted by his memories of the people he had wronged. I hadn't told my family exactly what day I was returning, because I wanted to surprise them. When I landed in Boston, I took the subway and then the Trailways bus to downtown Worcester and called the house where Glacieri answered the phone, suddenly hearing the shrieks of my sister and the ruckus of the children in the background. It was as if I had never left. After bombarding me with questions, Glacieri told me Father was at the coffee house. Go over there and find him, and he'll drive you home, she said, and hurry up. We want to hear everything that happened. When I got to the coffee house, I found my father playing cards with an impressive pile of dollar bills in front of him. But when he saw me, he threw down the cards, saying, "No more gambling today, my friends. My son has gone to the mountains and come back to me. Well, Nicola, tell me what tidings you bring from over there and how they treated you and how this new country looks to you now compared to the old world." "Pretty good, Patera," I said. "I missed you. Is this famous son, the one who has been to the White House and met the president?" asked one of the card players, a balding old man with a gold watch chain draped over an impressive paunch. "Perhaps this one will be president himself someday. My father switched into English to chastise the man properly. "What's the matter with you? My son born over across, so can't be president. Don't you know nothing, greenhorn? How you get your papers, anyway? Never mind, he gonna do pretty good, that's for sure. In this country, whatever he wants, he'll get it, but not president. He went back to the old country, and he come home to me. Educated son with college degree. Honors from the hand of the president. What more I want of life? Don't care if I drop dead tomorrow. I'm satisfied." Chapter 19. The Dance of Isaiah. You have trespassed and married foreign women. Although my father liked to express his satisfaction with life by proclaiming, "Don't care if I drop dead tomorrow," he survived for another 20 years after my return from Greece. Only at the end were we living in the same city, but we visited each other often, and each time I discovered something new about him and the bond that connected us. At Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, I was taught to cover the news of New York City by veteran journalists who ran the school something like Marine boot camp, berating and humbling us as we typed frantically against the deadline, threatening and warning that many of us would drop out or suffer nervous breakdowns before the year was over. Among my classmates were a number of women from all over the world, including a blue-eyed brunette from Minnesota named Joan Paulson. On Friday, November 22, 1963, she and I both had plans to go out with others, but when the news flashed across campus that President Kennedy had been shot, most of the J School students instinctively gathered in the newsroom. All afternoon, we stood around the clattering wire service machines as fragmentary bulletins about his condition came in. When it was over and Kennedy's death was official, we were all so despondent that no one had any idea what to do or where to go. Eventually that evening, a few of us wandered off to a nearby movie theater on Broadway, my usual place to take sanctuary when I couldn't cope with life, and I found myself sitting beside Joan. After that, we began dating, although I still went out with other women, including some whom I had known since Boston University. There were many glamorous and exotic co-eds at Columbia, students from many countries, and I had no intention of becoming involved with a WASP from Minnesota who was descended from six generations of Presbyterian ministers. Nevertheless, I was fascinated by Joan's honesty and complete lack of guile, a quality that was rare among Greeks of either sex. But I had a very clear demarcations between the kinds of girls I kept company with. There were Greek girls, one of whom I would eventually choose as my wife, and there were non-Greek girls whom I dated strictly for the purpose of having fun. Joan was a bit of a problem because she was much less worldly than the other girls I knew, and I decided that a non-Greek innocent was not someone I should waste my time on. Unfortunately, she invited me to be her guest at a Christmas dinner given by her dormitory. There was a party at the J school that same night. I told her that I would allow her to treat me to Christmas dinner if she would promise not to hang around me at the party afterward and cramp my style with the other girls. She agreed. At the end of our year-long master's program, my father drove from Worcester to New York City to attend my graduation. It was a warm, sunny day, and we graduates of the journalism school were filled with optimism about the careers that lay ahead of us. We had covered murders in Brooklyn, riots in Harlem, trials in night court, corruption in Albany. We had interviewed Malcolm X and Henry Kissinger, teenage drug addicts, and Madame New. We had done features on New York's morgues and theaters and hospitals and celebrities. It could make it there. If we could make it there, we told ourselves, we could make it anywhere. Before the ceremony, I asked Joan to take a graduation photograph of me and my father standing beneath the bronze statue of Thomas Jefferson outside the J School building, a snapshot that became one of my favorites because it illustrates so well the bond between father and son. He's standing straight as a soldier, pulling himself to his full 5 feet, 5 inches, beaming behind his wire-rimmed glasses. His shoes shine to dazzling brilliance. His AHEPA tie clasps glowing against his narrow blue tie, the picture of paternal pride. I, in my black robe, am humorously leaning with both arms on my father's shoulder, draped in an informal pose that suggests the constant teasing between us. It's clear from the photo that my father was exceedingly proud of my degree, but hardly too intimidated by my education to advise his son on any aspect of life. In fact, he proceeded to do so shortly after the ceremonies. "That girl, Jones, you introduced me to," he said. He never mastered the name Joan. "She's a very nice girl, very modest and seemly, doesn't wear makeup like most girls today." This was not true, but so it seemed to my father. "What a pity she's not Greek," he continued. "You find a Greek girl like that, you should marry her." The subject of marriage seemed to be still on his mind later that afternoon when I took him back to an apartment near Central Park, the quarters I was temporarily sharing with my old junior high friend, Phil Rosenberg. For most of the year, I had shared a room in a residence hotel on Broadway, one step from a welfare hotel. But my roommate had disappeared, leaving me far behind in the rent, and Phil had offered to take me in. In the years since, my father had driven me and the Rosenberg twins to Stratford to see Othello. Phil Rosenberg had become a student of English literature, and he too was now attending graduate school at Columbia, working on a thesis about the obscure 19th century playwright Dione Boucicault. Phil's living quarters were scarcely better than my cockroach-ridden hotel room. He rented a studio apartment on the first floor of a converted former brownstone, with every inch of wall space and table service covered with scholarly books. But Phil kindly offered me free use of the trundle bed that unfolded from beneath his own bed for as long as I needed it. "I want to thank you what you done for my son," my father told Phil as he searched for a spot to sit down. "I always say, Jewish people, nice people. You know, I almost married a Jewish girl one time before I met your mother, he said, looking at me. You did? We both exclaimed in amazement. That's right, he went on, pushing some books from a lopsided armchair and gingerly settling his considerable bulk in it. She lived near Ledge Street, where I live when I first come to America. All Jewish neighborhood, you know, Ledge Street, Water Street, Providence Street. She was on her family's porch one day, and I see her, and she smiles at me. I like her right off. Later, I see her shopping on Water Street, and I introduce myself. Well, she liked me back, and pretty soon we almost marry, but her parents very against it. She take it hard, get sick from worry, but her parents still against it. Finally, I tell her, if her parents against, you must always respect parents, most important thing. Then her parents take her away, and I never see her again. I don't know if she ever marry, but I hope she have a happy life. That's when I decide it's better to go back to Greece and marry my own kind. I never heard this story, I said, wondering whether it was true or it had been created as a cautionary tale for this occasion to remind me that marrying out of my ethnic group would be a mistake. You don't know everything about me, he said slyly. Do I know everything about you? I hope not, I answered, grinning. After graduation, my father returned to Worcester, and I set about hunting for the job that would be the entering wedge of my brilliant career. Throughout the year at Columbia, our professors had warned us to give up the idea of finding work in New York City. There was a hiring freeze on. Go to a good paper in a small city, get some solid experience, then you'll have a chance at New York. We had heard it so often we could tap dance to the refrain, but we really didn't believe it. We were the creme de la creme of journalism, as we had been told by the same professors. Columbia only took the top 10% of the applicants, and then forged them into ace reporters. Joan dutifully prepared to go back home to find a job, but for some reason, I didn't want to examine it too closely. The idea of never seeing her again bothered me. A few weeks before graduation, on a sunny spring day, we went on a romantic boat ride around Manhattan Island, and I said to her, how can you leave New York? Give it 2 weeks, and I'll do the same. You could share an apartment with other girls from the J School. Maybe we'll both find jobs, and then we could still see each other. She agreed to give it 2 weeks, no more, and within that period she did find a job, writing a company newspaper for a soap and toothpaste conglomerate with a skyscraper on Park Avenue. She would make $75 a week and share an apartment with three other Columbia graduates. Armed with my brand new master's degree, I made the rounds of all the newspapers and wire services, especially those people who had met me at the Hearst Awards ceremony a year before and offered me work. But now there were no jobs to be had, and I got nothing but apologetic turndowns. I was down to my last $14 before I found a temporary job replacing a vacationing writer for a small firm that wrote feature articles containing hidden plugs for paying clients. These promotional features were circulated free to newspapers across the country, where they were often run as news stories by small-town editors with a hole in their pages that needed fillings. I was told, for instance, to write about the exciting life of truck drivers to boost the image of the American Trucking Associations. Another story related how the French used pigs to find precious truffles, thus promoting the French truffle industry. For making such plugs interesting enough to be printed as a feature story, I was to be paid a weekly wage of $75 for the month the staff writer was on vacation. This certainly wasn't the career I had dreamed of, unveiling crime and corruption in the pages of New York Times. In fact, it was about the lowest form of journalism I could think of, except for making up lurid stories for supermarket tabloids. At night, when I lay on the cot in Phil's room, I was horrified at where I ended up after the glory of the Hearst Award and the White House visit. but I consoled myself, at least I could afford to eat for another month. In the middle of that hot, dismal New York summer, I took the bus back to Worcester to attend the Leotes Glendie, the day-long picnic celebrated each year by the immigrants from our village in a wooded area beside a lake in Marlborough. My brothers-in-law started marinating the chunks of lamb for the shish kebab the night before. There would be a Greek orchestra, a lottery with the first prize of plane tickets to Greece, and lots of eating, drinking, dancing, and singing. This annual picnic was an event that no one in my family would miss, because my father was the patriarch of the scores of Leotes living in Worcester, the revered first immigrant, or protoporos, whose efforts had brought everyone else over. As usual, Father was treated like a king at this event. Splendid in his light linen suit and new straw hat, he was seated in the place of honor, while babies and children were presented to him, and grateful relatives came up to greet him, many kissing his hand and addressing him as Papu. When the music began, he led the first dance, moving as always with a careful, stately step as he balanced a glass of wine on his bald pate. When he was tired of dancing, he sat on his makeshift throne to watch the rest of the dancers with the satisfied smile of one who knows that everything he surveys is the result of his own sweat and toil. This year, my father insisted that a chair be placed beside him for me as the community of immigrants came up to pay their respects. I tried to talk him out of it, for I felt like a fraud. The son who had been welcomed at the White House was now a penniless, hack-flogging, dubious feature stories. But my father wouldn't let me slip away. "You must sit here and greet everyone," he said, "for someday I won't be here anymore, and you will take my place." You have been listening to Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 578-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. Or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Naomi. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is Watching My Dog Sleep by Kate Tempest. Murphy is dreaming. His muscles are twitching. His ears are alive. His paws scrape the air. He's dreaming of yesterday, stones thrown into waves, the heartbreak of chasing what's no longer there. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal and read by me, Nikki Whichello. Thanks for listening, and may your life be filled. with poetic wonder.